I did not have sexual relations with that woman.
Yes or no? Did you ever take banned substances to enhance your cycling performance?
Yes.
I had no prior knowledge of the planned assault on Nancy Kerrigan.
I am deeply sorry for my irresponsible and selfish behavior I engaged in.
Welcome back to another episode of Oops the Podcast. Giulio Gallerati joined by the legend himself, 210 pounds of pure muscle, ready for summer, Ryan Lynch himself.
Thank you very much. I think that's an unsustainable amount of weight that you can add
Lynch
on a weekly basis. But thank you. I appreciate that.
You are welcome.
Wearing the cutoff t-shirt. There's a lot of confidence.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah.
Ryan Lynch, very Irish-American name. You look like you have Irish-American genetics.
I thought I did too. I did 23andMe. I'm not Irish.
Really? Wait, like a couple percentage points.
I know. I don't know though. But that's how it be.
Well, he knows it. He doesn't know. Well, without further ado, allow us to introduce our illustrious guest today. This man is hilarious. He has been around a very long time.
Oh, thanks. This guy's old.
How's that bad? People, that's a funny thing to get annoyed about, in my opinion. But I understand that that's the conventional thing, so I apologize. But very, very
that's
funny.
You're not older yet.
Yeah, dude, maybe that's why.
I'm going to remind you of this conversation in 15 years.
This guy's been around forever. He's a great comedian, and his story is so fascinating to me. So I'm looking forward to putting some of the pieces together. Make sure you go check out his special on YouTube. Des Bishop, everybody.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Finally. I feel like this is a finally that we're having this conversation.
I know. We've been trying to get you out here.
Organize it. We had everything work against us.
It's true.
Injuries and travel. And
yeah, our friend is a bit injured here under the weather physically.
6 weeks after ACL surgery, so.
How did you do it?
A ski fall. Quite a bad ski fall, which is bad because the sympathy drops when you tell people you're skiing.
Yeah.
And then when you tell them you're an Aspen, it just goes out. It actually turns to ire. from sympathy to hatred.
They wish for you a slow recovery at that point.
Yeah. So anyway, I'm 6 weeks today. So
can you walk us through the chain of events?
I mean, it's not that there's no great story other than, if you know Aspen, I wanted to hike the Highland Bowl, which is like a famous run, but you have to hike, you know. It was a very difficult hike, as it turns out. Way more difficult than I thought. My legs were like jelly. I was at the top of this place, 12,000 feet. I could hardly breathe. And I took like a nothing spill, but unfortunately, I just never stopped falling.
Fuck.
So I tumbled 1,400 feet.
The human body is delicate.
Yeah, my left ski didn't pop off, so it twisted and... There you go. But my initial feeling at the end when I finally stopped after tumbling for that long, I feel like I was falling for like 3 minutes. But the first guy that came up was like, "Are you all right?" And I was just like, "I'm so embarrassed." That was actually my feeling. I didn't know that I wouldn't be able to walk for over 2 months. My first feeling was embarrassment. I wasn't even really in that much pain. Like I stood up and I thought I might be all right. But anyway, it's fine. I did have to get tobogganed off.
Oh, damn.
And my skis are still at the Aspen Hospital. If anybody's looking for a pair of... 104 millimeter width, pretty good skis, lined skis. They're sitting in some container outside of the hospital in Aspen. There's nothing more Aspen than like, hey, take my skis. I couldn't give a shit.
Yeah, I was thinking that. Very privileged.
Anyway, we were working. My wife, Hannah Berner, had a show there, and you know, it was a ski resort, so I went with her. So it was a work trip. We're not Aspen people. I'm from Queens. Okay, so. I don't want people to get a false impression of my status as a human being.
You were from Queens via Ireland? Can you explain this to me once and for all? Because your brother, who I also know, Aidan Bishop, also a very funny comic, he was trying to... I've been putting these pieces together for quite a while, and I don't know the full story, so please put it to rest.
Well, it's very simple. I grew up in Queens. I was born in London, which just like really complicates everything. So kind of ignore that because they just waited for me to be born and then moved back to
ignored,
Queens.
Ignored.
Immediately.
Got it.
And I've never been wild about my British birth, to be honest with you. I was in Queens within 4 weeks of my birth. So I grew up in Flushing. I was just a normal Flushing kid. But then I flunked out of St. Francis Prep, freshman at Queens. And in a moment of like insanity where my mother was stressed out, she thought I was going to become like a fucking drug addict. And
were you a drug addict?
Well, I was drinking a lot, but my cousin, my older cousin had just gone through like hell with addiction. And
got it.
So there was a lot of like paranoia
in the genes
in my mother. Yeah. And a lot of alcoholism in our family in general. So genetically I was predisposed to most likely having a substance abuse problem.
Got it.
So My mother was really panicking. And a cousin of mine was visiting from Ireland, older cousin. She was like helping me with my summer school homework. And she actually said, why don't you go to boarding school in Ireland? And I was like, yeah, why don't I? And I said it to my mother, and they laughed originally, but 6 weeks later, I was living in Ireland. 6 weeks later, I went to boarding school in Ireland. And then I was only meant to be temporary, but then, you know, college is free there, so I stayed for college. And then when I was in college, I got into stand-up. And then I had a pretty decent career pretty quickly, enough that I would, like, never leave at that time. And then, you know, before I knew it, I've lived in Ireland most of my life.
But you guys are Irish?
Yeah, like, we're Irish-American. You know, like, my mother's actually born in New York, but her parents were Irish. You know, my grandmother was, like, with us for all, you know, until I was in my 20s, and she had a proper Irish accent. She was from West Cork. And, like, we were... my dad, by the way, had, like, a little bit more of an English accent, but he was raised in Cork. So he was an immigrant. He wasn't actually American. And so we were raised very Irish. Like, more Irish than, like... Even some of my friends whose parents were both of them from Ireland, we were very, like, obsessively Irish. It was a big part of our identity.
Totally. And that can be like a watered down lineage here because everybody's Irish. So if someone's like, I'm Irish, it doesn't mean they're like Irish, Ireland, Irish. And even if they are, it still doesn't mean anything to the point you just made.
Yeah, well, the Irish, I didn't know this until I moved to Ireland, but they do not accept Irish Americans as Irish.
Interesting.
So I kind of was a, they immediately attacked me for saying that I was Irish.
Interesting.
You know? And, you know, it's funny because at the time, because they would be like, you're American. And when you, Queens, our neighborhood in Queens, I'm not saying this goes for all Americans, but when we were kids, if you asked somebody, like, what's your nationality? You were really asking, like, what's your ethnicity or whatever. Mm-hmm. If somebody said, I'm American, we would be like, what do you mean you're American? There's no such thing as American.
Right.
You got to be something.
Right. You
know?
Right.
Because that was the Queens thing. Every, you know, it's a culturally diverse place.
Totally.
So it's like, yeah, okay, American is a given. We're not talking about your passport. I want to know, like, why you're hairy and I'm not. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, right.
So there was a lot of obsession with the people's different ethnicities.
That is broadly applicable here all in general, anyway. Like, it's even hearing somebody say they're American sometimes is, like, complicated.
Yeah, yeah. And,
we're too new of a country.
Exactly. It's a melting pot. Although right. I make the joke that it's not really a melting pot. It's a TV dinner because everyone has their own section. But, I think that that's fine. In fact, I actually feel like some of the discourse these days makes people afraid to ask, you know, like, what ethnicity are you? Which I think in a way is unfortunate because I always found it very interesting to find out about other people's ethnicities and how their upbringing might differ to mine.
Right,
you know,
right,
like,
right.
Like different, you know, if you're a first, second, third generation, you're going to have a very different, like, experience.
Totally.
So it's actually fun to know about that and to, you know, explore it. But I can also understand why some people get sensitive about it, because for some people, their motivations wouldn't be interest like mine was. It would be more, you know, like maybe something more nefarious.
Right, right. Well, how did growing up, did you guys visit Ireland?
No. So that's the crazy thing. The first time I went to Ireland was the day I went on my own, unaccompanied minor to on an Aer Lingus flight.
Wow.
So you have to wear like a
little badge.
Yeah, you get a badge.
Yeah.
And my cousins who I'd never met were waiting for me in Shannon Airport on the other side. So yeah, I'd never been to Ireland. So despite all our Irishness, we weren't one of these families that went, you know, and we were just like a busy family. My brother's a big soccer player. Embarrassingly, we modeled as kids for Ford modeling agency. So we were always like working. We didn't have time to go to Ireland. We were busy making money. We weren't like a big vacation family, actually. So anyway, the first time I went was on my own at 14 to move there. So I went to Ireland and I stayed with my cousins for a couple of days. And then I went to boarding school. April 26th.
Cool.
Was the day I arrived, actually.
So this is helpful. I didn't know any of this. I just thought you were like from Ireland and you lived in Queens. But like... somehow you had this like New York accent, even, I don't know. So
no, I'm really like a New York. So, cause I was in Ireland on my own. So every Christmas, sometimes Easter, always the summer, I would come back for the holidays. So, and my brothers never left here. Like I'm the only one that lived in Ireland.
Got
so
it.
I'm, you know, like I'm the only one that had this like other life experience. So I would come back to my parents, come back to my friends. So I never totally lost my Queens accent, which is stronger these days because I'm living here more.
Mm.
But there was a time when I was like not coming back a lot that my accent actually had gotten quite, not fully Irish. Irish people wouldn't have thought it was Irish, but when I would come back here, people would be like, oh, a bit of an accent. You know.
So can you tap into that right now?
Well, I mean, I whatever. When you ask me, I don't know what my Irish my Irish accent. But if an Irish person walked in, you would probably hear my accent shift a little bit.
A little code switching.
But I wouldn't consciously do it.
Right.
Which is funny because we always made fun of my dad for that. So my dad was raised in Cork, but lived in England a lot of his life. But then came here like in the 70s, you know, early 70s, met my mom. So my dad's accent would shift whoever he was talking to. We thought that was hilarious. And we'd make fun of him. You know, it was like whoever's on the, like, you know, say like, the joke in our house was like, Dad, it's Jim. And then he'd be like, hello, Jim. You know, and they're like, oh, it's Barry Goldsmith. Oh, hello, Barry. And we thought it was hilarious. But I thought he was like a phony. But I didn't realize that it's actually like natural. Because now I'm the same.
Interesting.
I'm literally, you become your parents.
So, yeah, right. We're being too hard on celebrities who sort of adopt accents when they live abroad for too long.
100%. And also, that's like, there are certain people that are more inclined. Like, and it's actually... It's embarrassing for them in terms of like people make fun of them. We go like, oh, look, she's lived in London for a year and now she's got an English accent. But actually that kind of like chameleon brain is actually good for an actor.
Mm.
And it's good for being able to do accents.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense for sure.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp.
BetterHelp, guys. What a great service to find a licensed therapist for all your therapy related needs. I've always been a firm believer that therapy is good for everybody, no matter what stage of your life you're in. You'd be surprised how helpful it can be in the past. I've gone during times where I didn't specifically need to. Like it was actually kind of random. The first time I ever went to therapy, I needed this specific clinic made you go to a psychologist if you were going to also go to a psychiatrist. Mm. So I had to do therapy and I really enjoyed it. And I was like, oh, this is a great thing. And then there are other times where there's work that you need to do and maybe it won't be quite as pleasant, but you get stuff done. And either way, it's like a great thing to be doing. I've really enjoyed doing BetterHelp because for a few different reasons. First of all, it's flexible. You do it completely remotely through your computer. The process of being matched with a therapist is super efficient as well. You take a little questionnaire. It's actually kind of fun to fill out, I'll be honest. It feels like you're getting interviewed. And you write down all of your criteria, what kind of person, as far as like their strengths go, like what kind of therapist do you want? In the past, I had just sort of been like matched with therapists when I was doing real life therapy. And to be able to sort of do a process of elimination of the specific things that you're interested in, I find to be very helpful, as well as the specific type of person you want to be your therapist. It's another thing you can pick. And then it's super simple. They set you up with somebody, you have your appointment. It's great. I've been doing it. I've really been enjoying it. And I think that if you're a person who either is looking for a great remote therapy option, is looking to start therapy, or is just looking for a new therapist, BetterHelp will cover you on all of these.
Yeah, that's right. So learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/oops today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, help.com/oops.
You started doing comedy in Ireland and then you started doing pretty well. Still, the word on the street is that you are like very famous in Ireland.
How? Yeah, I mean, I'm not. These days, it's calmed down a little bit. I haven't been doing as much in Ireland for quite a while, but no, there was a time where it was.
You couldn't like walk down the street?
Oh, yeah. I mean, so I did this television series in 2000. Well, we filmed it in 2003, but it was on in 2004. Did you ever read the book Nickel and Dimes by Barbara Ehrenreich? I mean, it was a big book at the time. But I happened to have read it, and this producer came to... So it was about a journalist went undercover, but she was living on minimum wage. And it was really about the American minimum wage experience.
I think I did read this, actually, in college.
Yeah. So it would have been around that time.
Yeah, it came out. Book. Okay. Yeah. I do remember this.
So, book. And it was a great read. I'm not like the best reader of all time, but when this producer came to me, I happened to have read it. And she was like, yeah, I really want to do like a documentary version of this in Ireland, but you know, we'd have to get, it won't be undercover. You know, you'll have permission. And so she wanted to make like an entertaining, but informative documentary about low wage life in Ireland. So I was like, yeah, I'm definitely, I can do that, you know? And so who knew that ended up being like massive, right? There was loads of reasons why. I won't bore you, but Ireland was changing a lot at that time. I'm sure you may be aware of Ireland used to be like an exporter of people, and then they became like an importer of people.
Right.
And that transition was all happening then.
It's all like corporate tax break stuff? Is that
well,
all?
Well, it's the Celtic time. You know, the Irish economy really boomed in the early 2000s. It was, and in the midst of that boom, you had all these new workers coming. So I ended up doing a lot of these jobs with like foreign workers. It's like a new Ireland that people hadn't seen. So
what do you mean jobs? What jobs were you doing?
So like the first
during
job,
this documentary?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry. Yes. Yeah. So I did four jobs, 1 month each.
Cool.
The series was four episodes.
So this was a smash hit.
Yeah. The first episode was in a kebab shop called Abracababra, which in Ireland is a chain, but outside of Ireland, people always think the name is kind of funny, but
Abracababra, that's clever. Yeah.
And their main business really was like after the pubs, after the clubs, like drunk people eating.
Which, why has that turned into what it is? That's what it is here too.
Yeah.
What is that?
I guess it's a convenient type of food, and maybe also like these things naturally happen, right? People go like, you know, these businesses go, hey, we're making a lot of money at night, and slowly it drifts throughout the world, you know, the Lebanese and the Turks and all these people that open these stores. Right. They go like, you're going to kill it if you
there's
stay
a
open.
Model.
Yeah.
Got it. Yeah.
Anyway, this place was, by the way, it was Irish owned. This was just like an Irish chain. But anyway, that series, that episode particularly was largely about how badly these new workers were being treated. And there was a lot of chaos around the drunkenness. And it was not the most flattering light that Irish people were looking at themselves. And there was me, you know, when you're like I was young, like I was 27, comedian. I had no filter. I really was like fearless, not fearless like that I was brave, fearless in that I was fucking stupid. Like I
stupid. There it is.
I didn't think like about what was going into the lens and how.
Oh yeah. You don't know yet. You don't realize what you might look like.
But the naivety was to my advantage because I was very honest about what
you were
I was
just
seeing.
Raw, dude.
And it was pretty critical of Ireland, but like, anyway, that episode, the rest of the series was very successful too, but that episode like changed my life. Like, because that you got to remember, this is still the time, it's 2004, so this is still the time where people really tuned into TV. And
totally.
That was
social
like,
media had only sort of begun.
Yeah, and that next day, I remember the next day, like being in Dublin city center and just like suddenly everybody was looking at me like it changed overnight.
Cool.
You know? And, but the series was a good series. I mean, and by the way, I really did it. So the thing was that I had to live on the wage, you know, and I really did do it because like Aaron Reich's book, you can't, so part of it was that you do stand up about the experience. So we didn't have like traditional narration. The narration came from
cool.
a live stand up show.
Cool. Cool.
And you cut back and forth. So it was always, meant to be hard-hitting but funny. So you cut back and forth to the stand-up.
You're like, so then I was doing this, and then it shows it.
Yes.
Great.
And so you have
great
the both
format.
You have the both things going. But the thing was that people would be like, oh, did you cheat? It was like, well, I couldn't cheat, could I? Because I had to write jokes. I had to experience things to be able to talk
totally,
about
totally, totally.
So actually, cheating, I don't mean cheesy, like I would have been cheating myself, but actually, like I would have made my job harder by cheating.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Because yeah.
I had to have the real experiences of like how much money. And honestly, largely the series was not that much about the money because at that time it would be different now. But at that time, I just about got away with it. And honestly, a lot of these.
Got away with what?
The money. Like I.
Without making money?
Like it was just about enough money for me to get by.
Right. Got it.
Like it was a frugal life.
Right.
But it was.
Was there any sort of back end incentive other than fame? Like, were you supposed to get paid because of this or that? Or
no. I was working for real. I got paid as a worker.
And that was it.
None of it was fake.
But like it was done, there was no like kicker money for you or like.
Well, no. I mean, I got paid for the series.
Right.
But that's independent.
Later.
Yeah. Later.
Okay.
Yeah.
Got it.
No. And I really did live on the money, but like there wasn't that many. You know, throughout the four episodes, the money itself wasn't as much of a theme as you would think. A lot of it was about, you know, the type of jobs, the way people treat you. And again, like, because Barbara Ehrenreich's book was pretty hard-hitting, but you're looking at, like, single moms, like, trying to get by in Walmart and, like, not having
totally,
health insurance.
Totally.
Like, in Ireland at that time, it was mostly immigrant workers that were, like, they were working 80 hours a week. Like, to them, they were thinking, like, this is not bad. And then, like, one job was in, like, a water park. And most of them were, like, young people working, you know, like summer jobs and stuff like that. So we weren't dealing with too many people that were really struggling to get by. I think you wouldn't be able to make that series in Ireland today because the cost of living is so high.
Interesting.
The rental crisis in Dublin is the same as here, you know, if not worse.
It's really expensive.
Yes. And so, like, every now and then I'll see somebody mention online, like, imagine the Des Bishop work experience today, like, he wouldn't be able to make it. And I have to agree.
Interesting.
Like, it would just be a lot harder to survive the way that I did. Because I got a place in Dublin. I paid real rent in Dublin. You know, I lived in Dublin, but I walked away from my Dublin life, rented a bed sit, you know, with a shared bathroom with other apartments. And I made my money and I got by. Now, I didn't have much of a life, but I got by for that month on that money. Right. There's no way I could do that now.
So, okay. Was the fact that that money was able to kind of allow you to live, period? And like, to your point, it wasn't like it was single moms, whatever. You're a young guy.
Yes.
Supporting yourself. Great. But do you think that that was specific to some sort of like European experience? Meaning like it's easier for any worker to theoretically survive in Europe versus the US? Or was it just like it was before the time where it became expensive there? And now it's just as bad as here.
I think, well, there's certain things that, well, first and foremost, like there's a lot of life costs that are just not as prohibitive there, like health and education, stuff like that. So, you know, there's just not as much of that stuff that would come into it. But like Dublin life is definitely a lot more expensive than it used to be. Like a lot of the immigrant workers that come now, like they live in these like horrible living situations.
You're right. Right. Like 17 guys are there type thing.
Yeah. Because because you literally can't get a place.
Yeah.
And it's a big issue. I mean, it's the main issue in like the Irish election, but I still would say that it would be easier there than here just because health is the health insurance thing is the big cost difference.
Yeah.
You know, like your life wouldn't be over like if you got sick in Ireland. Like it's not ideal, but you wouldn't have that. And we covered that a little bit. Like a lot of stuff had to go my way for me to like not have a financial issue, and because it was only a month, right? So it's hard for any like real crisis. And if we like manufactured like a real crisis, I feel like that wouldn't be fair. It's like fake, you know.
Totally.
So you know, I got by. But again, the series is very honest about like that it's a boring life, you know, like I wasn't going out. I wasn't spending money, you know, and like there was a scene in the Waterford episode where like I had a day off and I treated myself to like a latte in a coffee shop.
God.
But the appreciation of it was amazing.
I'm sure.
I bought the Irish Times back when you bought the paper. I bought the Irish Times and a latte and I cherished every word. Like I perused the paper for like 2 hours. It just felt so nice to have this like me time.
Totally. And I think there's something about that that's interesting about the idea that a treat is a treat. Whatever treat you can afford or to give yourself, whether it's money, time, whatever it is, feels the same no matter where you are.
Yes.
Which is interesting and worth examining. To some degree.
Yes, to a degree. The only problem is that I guess the very rich people would be like, well, look, they're just as, they're just as happy.
But it's true. And you had experienced better life, but like enough time had gone by where you were used to your shitty life.
Yes.
And this latte felt the same as, you know, a Saturday morning blowjob.
Yeah. Well, you know, spiritually, I think spiritually, that's a good exercise. And like, just, you know, gratitude is, it's probably a good thing to stay in touch with, you know, not, you know, I mean, everybody's grateful for a Saturday morning blowjob.
You seem like a grateful guy to me. Would you say you are? Are you just hiding it?
Depends.
Are you more cynical than you let on to be?
Oh, no. I mean, I can be very cynical. You know, it's easier to be cynical in Ireland anyway. You know, like Americans are more earnest in general. The Irish are actually more naturally cynical, more naturally sarcastic.
Yeah.
And actually, like, more brutal, like, in terms of the humor. Like, the banter in Ireland, I would say, naturally is more brutal than it is here.
Interesting. I've had some very interesting encounters with Irish people where they were like super, and like, I'm not trying to make a blanket judgment, but this has specifically happened with like Irish people where if I was like saying something where I wasn't like taking a stand, I would get criticized. They'd be like, listen to you. Like, you just said nothing. Like, you got to stand for something or else I don't respect you. Like some shit like that.
Wow.
I
was that's
Jesus
heavy,
Christ. I'm like, sorry, dude. I'm like, I don't know. You know,
I don't know. Well, you know, when I go on the, you know, when I go to like Australia or over here, so if I do my own show in a place where there's a lot of Irish people, they'll come see me, you know, and they always go, I don't know how you do comedy here. They have no sense of humor. Australians, Canadians, right. Americans, the Irish will always say, they have no sense of humor. And I know what they're saying because the Irish sense of humor is very specific, mm-hmm. you know, and it's quite biting, but like in a way that's just like we understand, you know, like people ripping the piss out of strangers. The joke I say in Ireland is they do have a sense of humor. They just don't have an Irish sense of humor in that. When you meet somebody for the first time and you call them a cunt, they get offended. You know, Irish people are just very familiar very quickly too. That's the other thing.
Interesting. But yeah, I mean, like, not to compare, because I know that this is like, they're not like people who get along, but like the British also have a pretty biting, sort of nasty sense of humor that, you know, is probably more evolved than the American, Canadian, Australian.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely different, although it always bugs me the way British people think they have this like superior humor, but there's some cultural reasons for that too. But, I think traditionally that was the case, but actually I feel like to a degree they might be getting left behind these days. I feel like America is really punching above its weight comedy wise these days. But overall, I think that, you know, also in the UK, you know, you need to be on your toes a bit more in conversation. I do think that there is more like just of a natural wit in everyday life. Maybe it's more appreciated, more accepted. I don't know, but I think that's a fair, it's a fair observation.
And they also have access to like a broader vocabulary than some of their sort of other Anglo-speaking peoples, which allows them to say more stuff.
But all the English-speaking countries outside of the United States, perhaps Canada, I can't really speak for Canada, but like Australia, Ireland, the UK, other places, they also are just naturally more exposed to the rest of the world.
Totally.
American media is largely sort of American-centric, whereas in these other places, you're getting American culture as well as your own culture, as well as the, you know, all the other stuff. So I do think that that gives you possibly like just a naturally broader understanding of the world.
Agreed. And it just sort of inherently makes you just a slightly more sophisticated, leaning in that direction at least.
I think slightly more sophisticated would be fair. Although the Irish don't pride themselves on sophistication. The Irish pride themselves on crack, which I'm glad about. Crack as in the C-R-A-I-C, like having fun, which I'm glad about because the one thing I always feel when I go to the UK, because I, you know, I used to spend some time doing shows in the UK, but the one thing I always miss when I'm in the UK versus Ireland is that like, they're just not as fun. I mean, whatever, I'm not talking about funny.
Yeah.
Like, Irish people are just more fun. They're naturally warmer. Mm-hmm. And there's just something missing, you know, when you're in the UK versus Ireland, you know.
Guys, let's be real. Investing can be intimidating. And if you're anything like me, you've been putting off investing because you've got no idea where to even start.
Sigh.
That's where Acorns can help. Today's episode is sponsored by Acorns. Acorns makes it easy to start automatically saving and investing for your future. You do not need a lot of money or expertise to invest with Acorns. In fact, you can get started with just your spare change. Acorns recommends an expert-built portfolio that fits you and your money goals, then automatically invests your money for you. Head to acorns.com/oops or download the Acorns app to start saving and investing for your future today. Client testimonial may not be representative of all clients. Tier 1 compensation provided. Compensation provides an incentive to positively promote Acorns. View important disclosures at acorns.com/oops. Investing involves risk, including the loss of principal. Please consider your objectives, risk tolerance, and Acorns fees before investing. Acorns Advisors LLC is an SEC registered investment advisor. Brokerage services are provided to clients of Acorns by Acorns Securities LLC, member FINRA/SIPC. For more information, visit acorns.com.
Okay, so question. So you had this show, you're 27 when the show comes out. You'd begun doing stand-up when you were in college, and you suddenly turned into this, you know, promising comedian in Ireland when this producer approached you. Is the picture you're painting, is that accurate?
I had already like got a little bit of a name within the industry.
You were sort of like a hot guy.
I had heat.
When I say hot, everyone listening, I don't mean like sexually hot, although I'm sure you look great too, as you still do.
I mean, it wasn't a competitive field in terms of hotness in comedy. It still isn't.
Yeah, it still isn't. I mean more of sort of like a person who was sort of emerging.
Yeah, yeah, no, I definitely was that. I was that guy at that time. Cool. You know?
So then you get the show, whatever. And then, leading up to that, you were making a living doing comedy.
Yeah, I made a living doing comedy pretty quick because I had the unique angle on Ireland, right? I was an outsider, but I was educated in Ireland and I could do all the accents. And truth be told, it was a little easy for me, which was to my detriment outside of Ireland. But Irish people really loved me talking about Ireland because I had a slightly different take. And Irish comedy scene was pretty new. So, you wouldn't have had like a huge amount of guys making a fish out of water observations about Ireland. So it was pretty easy for me to be novel because nobody had done what I was doing before. And that's not, I'm basically criticizing what I was doing. It was just the Irish were responding way too well to what was largely pretty basic comedy.
Right. Got it.
So early on, I got decent momentum pretty quickly as a result of that. Right. But obviously, I also had good stage presence, charisma. The performance stuff was the natural, but the actual material was pretty basic. But Irish people really were like eating it up. And obviously, I leaned into that. But, it was to my detriment outside of Ireland because those jokes literally only work in Ireland.
Got it. So as you started to do comedy elsewhere, you needed to
figure out. I had an hour in Ireland. I had like 5 minutes when I went to Edinburgh. Like, it was crazy how sort of like ill-equipped I was for anything outside of Ireland.
So Edinburgh, you go and you do your own sort of one-man show for a month,
I did that a couple of different times.
You promote it yourself on the street. It's like this whole crazy boot camp of doing a one-man show, basically, right? I've never done it, but...
2002, I did a show called Comical Warfare because that was post 9/11, so there was a lot of talk about anthrax and chemical warfare. So I called a show Comical Warfare. And I had some post 9/11 material, the world and all that stuff. And actually, that was like my first time where I did well in Edinburgh because I'd done shows before. But 2002 was like, wow, I'm actually becoming a decent comic outside of Ireland.
Yeah.
But actually, what happened was I got the series 2003. So actually, I canceled the run. I canceled my 2003 run. And, that was really the end of my outside of Ireland journey until 2008, because then my life completely changed. So then it really didn't make any sense to leave Ireland because we were making it rain.
Fuck yeah.
No. I mean, it was pretty wild there. Around that time, it was pretty wild. But, just coincidentally enough, comedy-wise, right? So 2002 was Flight of the Conchords, their first year in Edinburgh. We were all hanging out. Taika Waititi was doing a show with one half of Flight of the Conchords, Jermaine. Taika was doing a show called The Humor Beasts. And we were all just like playing tip rugby together in the park. And everybody went off to have Daniel Kitts. Like all the, John Oliver used to play football. We used to play football at, like, always in the Meadows. Like John Oliver, Daniel Kitson, Andy Zaltzman, like all these guys all ended up having like, different types of careers throughout the year. But that 2002 vintage was actually like it was a pretty good time.
Yeah. Pretty good group. It sounds like too. Wait, so now I'm not understanding where China fits in.
It's way later.
So how much later, how, why, how'd you learn how to speak Chinese? So guys, before we get into all this, Dez is the only person I've ever seen who can literally do comedy in Chinese, and he's like killing in Chinese. Now, this is a complicated
language. I know other white dudes that can do it, by the way.
But I don't.
Yeah, Jesse Appel is
who's that? I don't know him. Should I know him? Is that
you wouldn't know him from the industry? He's very much a guy that did stand up in Mandarin. But his Mandarin is infinitely better than mine. I mean, he was when I was there, he was there on a Fulbright. And he was studying Chinese humor, but he's literally like almost as fluent as you could be without being like a native speaker.
So what does he do though? Is he like touring internationally and doing
he's around now. You'll see him. You see some videos with Zhao Ying Summers. There he is. You can see him there. But like, so he had a viral recently where he's doing his joke about the Boston accent in Mandarin on Chinese TV. But anyway, whatever. He's a great guy. Very good. Very knowledgeable about tea. but he has a T page. But anyway, so there are others. But so very quickly, the minimum wage series worked really well. So then that became kind of a format. Dez has an experience and does stand up about it and makes like a entertainment documentary. So the next one I did stand-up comedy workshops in traditionally disadvantaged areas. So it was called Join the Hood, right? And it was basically like trying to get traditionally marginalized voices into the comedy scene. Because actually in Ireland, particularly at that time, comedy was very middle class. You know, like very few guys were coming out of these tough neighborhoods doing stand-up. In America, you had this tradition of like, you know, basically hilarious black dudes that were coming out of like tough upbringings and making jokes and giving a voice to, you know, people from bad neighbors. But that was not happening in Ireland. So anyway, I did that series. That was fine. And then the third series I did was I learned the Irish language. So I lived in the Gaelic, the speaking area where they still speak that as a first language. And I lived there for a full year, completely immersed, lived with a family to do stand up in Gaelic.
How difficult was that to learn?
It's fine. You know, if you have a year of your life to make it your full-time job, you will get pretty proficient in the language.
Any language, you think?
I do, actually. Yeah. I think that most people don't know that because who gets the...
No one gets to do that.
Who gets that opportunity, totally. Right? So I had this opportunity. And as my Irish language mentor, Micheál O'Fuil, he always said to me, the two most important things for learning a language, or three most important things, are a good language environment, access to good learning materials, and motivation. So there's no better motivation than knowing that the entire nation is going to watch your progress on TV when you're done.
Totally.
So I was very motivated to not fail. And I was really in a good language learning environment, because the thing about learning Irish that's difficult is that everyone can speak English.
Right.
So they basically have to do you a favor
exactly.
to be patient with you while you struggle through
right.
this other language. But luckily, because people knew me, they knew what I was doing, I got more goodwill than the average person that would go got down it. There trying to learn the Irish
language. Which is not a good language learning environment, in theory.
In
because
theory.
If people hear you being like, me gusta los, they're like, what do you want to?
Yeah, what do you want?
You know what I mean? And like, you're like, oh, okay.
Exactly.
Yeah, so exactly. I even noticed that when I've gone anywhere where they do not speak English at all, how quickly I start picking up phrases that are important. And then I can reach into them, even not trying to toot my own horn here. But when I did a video in Ecuador, I did this video where I'm eating a bunch of different fruits. And Francis was literally like, dude, do you speak Spanish? And I'm like, no, just none of these people spoke English. And like, I would literally just look on my phone at what the thing was, and then I could do it. But it's easier when it's the same alphabet. It's kind of a familiar language, et cetera, et cetera. So it
yeah,
makes
but
me
the,
wonder,
the thing is that
Gaelic has a different alphabet, right?
No, not really, no. No, there's a little bit of difference, but these days especially.
Similar, okay.
Yeah, but I had that experience in France. Middle of the pandemic, Hannah and I went skiing and we were in Geneva, and it was like this chaotic thing where you had to get a test within like
oh, God.
7 hours
the
of flying.
Worst fucking
and
thing
it
ever.
Turned out it was like right at the beginning of Omicron, and suddenly like we were like in the middle, like everybody was like, I gotta get in. It was chaos.
God.
And suddenly like my crappy French from like 1 year of French in high school, like suddenly we were like getting by, and Hannah was like, like, where did this come? I was like, I don't know. It's just we just fucking need it right now. It's funny how necessity makes the words just come.
Totally. But you all, there is a chance that you are just gifted with language.
Well, yeah, but that I don't actually, I was not good at language in school.
Okay.
Like I actually hated
it. Is anyone?
I hated it.
Okay.
So
it's such a bad way to learn a language.
So the thing about the Irish language series was I did it. And it was great. Now, it was very easy to be funny in Gaelic in Ireland because everyone, it's compulsory in Ireland to study it in school. So everyone has had the learning experience. So all my comedy, largely about Gaelic, was like jokes about learning it and jokes about the language.
Right.
So actually, I had a bad breakup. I was engaged. Bad breakup 2008, right at the end of that.
Damn.
Like 6 weeks to go, we broke up. And so suddenly my whole life was like I could do whatever I wanted. And
was that positive?
Well, it was in the sense that when I did the minimum wage documentary, when I was working in Abracababra, I was working with a lot of Chinese. They were the people that I was working with. And I had visited them in 2004 when they went back home for a vacation. And I had like a very authentic Dongbei, like Northeastern Chinese experience. And it Dongbei? Really triggered, like an obsession with wanting to learn Mandarin. Because don't forget, to go right back to the beginning of this conversation,
yeah.
I'm also from Flushing, Queens, which in my lifetime became entirely Chinese.
Totally.
And my parents' house, the neighbors, a lot of them didn't even speak English. And like, if I was home and it was a snow day, I'd be shoveling snow with them. And like, we couldn't fucking talk. So I was like obsessed with trying to learn Mandarin, but never like think I would get the time.
Right.
But now I'm not getting married anymore. I could do whatever I want. So I was like, hey, let's do this in China. You know, learn Mandarin to do stand-up in Mandarin. However, it wasn't as easy to get that off the ground.
Right. So who do you talk to make that happen? The same people who had made your previous shows?
Yeah, yeah. Originally, I was going to Irish
TV. So these other shows had done well, like The Hood Show or whatever?
Oh, yeah. They were all very successful.
Doing great. Okay. So you're like...
And the Irish one particularly was hugely successful. The impactful to my life, the first series was more, but like as a series, like the Irish one was very well received, won right. loads of awards and all that type of Amazing. Stuff. So the... Originally, I was trying to get it for Irish TV, and then that kind of didn't happen. Then my dad got sick, 2009, my dad got sick. So that was like, everything stopped. So then suddenly it was like looking after my dad. I ended up doing a whole show about that, made a documentary about that. So made a whole other TV show about my dad, which actually ended up on Irish TV in 2011. He died actually like 4 days after it came out on Irish TV.
Wow.
And then, so then when that was all done and the dust had sort of settled with all that, this guy... A travel documentary company came to me and he was like, hey, we want to do a travel doc. I was like, listen, man, I'm not interested in really doing travel documentary. I said, however, I have this idea that kind of just got shelved that I would love to maybe try to re-look at. And he had the right like skill set for what that would entail, you mm-hmm. know? So that guy actually, that company called Crossing the Line, they actually got the China project off the ground. But it still took well over a year because... He was trying to get all these alternative sources of funding, which just they wouldn't go for because all the funding for Irish TV largely was geared towards like projects about Ireland.
Right.
And this was like really not Irish. So we never actually got the funding. In the end, we made that for very cheap, the China project. So the China idea was basically from 5 years from let's do this to actually happening because I went there in February of 2013.
Wow.
But the main premise was... By the way, don't forget, like when I first pitched the idea, it was the winter of 2008. It was leading up to the Beijing Olympics. You know, there was just an increasing like obsession with China
buzz.
Yeah. And China, you know, the economic power. And,
right.
You know, but by the time I went, actually, Xi Jinping was about to come into power. So like a lot had gone on in the meantime, like China was increasingly prosperous. So I was basically like, I want to tell the story of China through the idea of learning language and through humor. And really focusing on the people because everyone tells stories of China about political strife, you know, like it would always like stealing ideas and, you know, like it was quite negative. And it wasn't like I was trying to dismiss how horrible the Communist Party was, but I was like, there's 1.4 billion people here. Let's find out who they are. So, I mean, by the way, it's just a shitty little documentary for Irish TV, but that was my motivation going into it was I want to tell the story of Chinese people through humor.
Got it.
You know?
And the goal, in addition to that, was you were going to learn Mandarin.
That's the hook. So the hook is after 1 year, you do stand-up in Mandarin.
Got it.
Which means that you got to learn a lot about a place. Oh, not yeah. You don't have to just learn the language, but you got to learn a lot about a place and learn a lot about the culture to be able to make them laugh. Right, in their own language. So if you can do that, you're obviously going to have a ton of cool experiences that are also going to translate into like a fun thing to watch.
Totally.
And also, I felt like the world was curious enough about China that they would want to see this.
Right. Know?
So that all that is the whole package that goes into the China project.
Cool. And then, so that ended up coming out on Irish TV?
That came out on Irish TV. We thought maybe that it would get more international interest, but it only ever got sold to SBS. That's Australian television. Mm. We also, by the way, while we were there, had an offer from Beijing TV, which sounds like local TV, but, you know, there's 20 million people in Beijing, so it's a pretty big station.
It's bigger than most countries.
Yeah, yeah. BTV is pretty big, actually, because it's not just Beijing. Anyway, like...
That's ridiculous.
So they offered a very small amount of money, but they offered to co-pro, right, to co-produce with a Chinese version of our show that would then come out on Beijing TV, which I was very excited about. However, would you believe, and I haven't told this story in a long time, Irish television said no because they felt that... people would say that you weren't an independent voice about China, that there would have been a conflict.
Do you agree with that?
No.
That's ridiculous.
Because, first of all, we were never, it was never our mission to be that, you know? But also, you know, they were just covering their end because they're public broadcaster, you know?
Yeah.
But, like, that conflict of interest was just total bullshit, you know? Right. And, like, it was really unfortunate for us because whatever about the fact that Beijing TV offered very little money, they were offering, like, quite a lot of resources that we really, I could have used.
They were offering a lot of resources?
Well, yeah, just they have it all there.
Access, I mean,
you're talking about, like, yeah. You're talking about, like, a massive, you know, like, you're talking about the equivalent of, like, you know, NBC's New York office. Like, all the resources that
totally,
are there.
Totally, same deal.
At Rockefeller Center, like, I would have had access to, like, quite a lot of that, totally. You know? Like, cameramen when my guy wasn't over, because my guy wasn't there full-time.
Right.
Also, just, like, ability to get on shows. You know, so it was very annoying, actually.
I'm sure.
And, like, you know, let's face it, it would have been pretty good for me to have a Chinese version of the show.
Yeah, so you would have made a bunch of money.
I wouldn't have made a bunch. Who knows?
So but, what would have been
by the way, the Beijing TV version, God knows what it would have been. It would have been like a propaganda fest, but I wouldn't have cared. It would have
wait,
been
but my, I thought you said it was not going to be a propaganda fest.
No, but their version.
Oh.
The BTV version.
So that is that what Ireland had a problem with, though?
No, Ireland had a problem with that people would criticize and say that we weren't being honest because of the conflict that Beijing TV was behind it. They basically just didn't want a Chinese broadcaster as a co-pro because people would say that you didn't have the freedom to say what you wanted.
Right, okay. But so, but I'm not understanding because you're saying that the Chinese version would have indeed...
Oh, the Chinese version. Been, who cares about the
Chinese version? But okay, so the Chinese version is just them translating it in a way that was helpful for them as opposed to
the reality
your version?
Is that if you understand China, they would have no choice.
You're right. No, I get that. Yeah,
but
yeah.
But they
yeah.
wouldn't have had any... They wouldn't have had any... editorial control over what we did in Ireland.
Totally. And yeah, you're the one making the show. So once you've made the show, they then yeah. just repurpose it.
But that, yeah. And whatever they did, I wouldn't have cared. Like, I literally wouldn't have cared. It wouldn't have been like,
right.
It just would have been like a huge bonus to have had all those resources. And like, when you live in China for a while, you just know like, yeah, we're not doing anything controversial over here.
Right.
You know, you can say what you want when you get back to the West, but we're not doing anything controversial over here. But at the end of the day, particularly then, there was just so much of that critical stuff about China that like I didn't feel any obligation to really be getting into that.
Right.
You know? And yeah. I had the freedom to do it if I wanted, but it just wasn't a story that like I was encountering or needed to be told. And I was very honest about in Breaking China, I was very honest about censorship and, you know, like all the stuff that goes with live performance and having to apply to the censor, all that stuff is in Breaking China. So we didn't hold back on anything that I was encountering, you know, which by the way is a lot worse now.
Mm.
Things have gotten a lot less free in China since I was there. Xi Jinping is awful. And he's really cracked down on, you know, like entertainment particularly. And, you know, it's directly affected people I know. So, you know, I don't even think we would have been able to make it.
Interesting.
Nowadays, I don't think we would have got permission to do it.
Actually. Interesting. How?
Well, we had a guy with us. CARFT is the organization.
CARFT.
CARFTE.
That is an organization or a guy?
That's the Chinese body that looks after
it's foreign like a
media, foreign media nice. In China. So our guy Chen was with us, but after a while he trusted us. He didn't. We were able to film without him like a lot.
Right.
And there was no issue. And he's
oh, that's cool.
Yeah. I have him on.
Like we go, dude.
One of the jokes I did towards the end was I took the Chinese news sting, the Xinwen Liangbo was their like evening news, and they have a very obvious like musical beginning, and I turned that into like a hip hop beat, and I made a Xinwen Liangbo rap in Mandarin, and I performed it at my. You know, I started a Chinese language comedy like show at this place with another Chinese comedian, and I performed that. And I have Chen on camera. It's in the series, by the way. My censor laughing at a joke that is 100% not cool. he's just laughing away because I'm basically making a joke about how Chinese news is propaganda.
You know? He's like, oh, it's true.
Yeah, because that's like a running joke in China. It's like Chinese news every night is. The government are working the people are happy, and the West is a mess.
Right, right, right.
That, and literally, if you watch, so that's basically the joke. It's like, oh, look at the government; they're working hard. Look at the Lao Bai Xing, the everyday Chinese person is happy, and there will always be some like at a factory, and they're all just like, yeah, we're doing great. And then it'll always be like bombs, like these days would just be like Russia bombing Ukraine, and, you know, like Joe Biden stumbling over his words, you know what I mean? Like whatever. Or like January 6th, they would have fucking feasted on that.
Yeah, right. Guys, if you're looking for a perfect gift this Mother's Day, we highly recommend giving your mother the gift of StoryWorth, which is a wonderful vehicle to preserve precious memories for many years to come. Such a cool gift. Over time, the recipient of the gift will receive a series of questions that they'll get periodically. They can be things that are vague or more specific, and they can choose to answer which ones they want. And over time, as they answer all of these questions, a story will be compiled, basically of their life. A lot of the times, people from the sort of generation before, in my opinion, are less likely to share stories with you unless you ask, because they're sort of in this caregiver role. Specifically, I feel like with a mother, I don't know. Like, of course, they'll tell you some stuff, but you're not asked. You're so used to that you're not asking them the kind of questions that you should be asking them. And therefore, you never unlock certain memories or stories that you may never hear unless you were to ask. And that's why it's cool that StoryWorth can kind of serve as that medium. Get them talking, right? Get mom talking. And after, you know, a period of time, after a year goes by, I believe it is.
Yeah, it's a full year.
Full year, it will compile a keepsake book that effectively turned all of the stories from your loved one into a literal book. That you can have and cherish forever. You know, if you're away, you miss them, whatever you want to do with it. It's a great thing to have, and it's a very cool thing for you guys to share with each other. And it's really cool that it exists because, I don't know, it allows you to get closer to certain people that you love if there's stuff that you don't know about them yet.
Yeah, it's like it's a thoughtful gift.
Agreed.
It's not something you pick up at a little tchotchke store and then just throw a little card in there. Like, it's a memory that you have forever. That's why StoryWorth has over 25,000 five-star reviews on Trustpilot. So give all the moms in your life a unique, heartfelt gift you'll all cherish for years. StoryWorth, right now, save $10 on your first purchase when you go to StoryWorth.com/oops. That's StoryWorth.com/oops to save $10 on your first purchase.
I think that this topic, what you're talking about right now, is one of the most interesting things I've ever heard about in comedy or related to comedy. I know you did it a while ago, and I'm sure at the time, like, everybody's talking about it was a big thing, but like, I don't understand why I'm not sitting at the table at the Cellar and we're not like, can you guys believe Dez can do comedy in Chinese?
Oh yeah, it's funny, Ronnie Chang always says that too. Like, Ronnie Chang recently was on Craig Ferguson's podcast, and he was telling Craig Ferguson about my story, and he was like, yeah, it's like, he's like, it's incredible, and he really doesn't get enough credit for it.
Yeah, no, I believe that, and I don't want to act as if it doesn't get credit, because obviously it does. It was on TV. It was literally like, and you've had
I was, one of my frustrations is that we weren't able to do more with it. The problem was, though, it was very badly funded, so like, it's just not like, It was made as good as it could be, but like, right, it's probably lacking. Like, it's lacking the shine that would be required. And I have to tell you that what I've noticed particularly, because after that I tried to get an Arabic version of the same thing, but I was no longer going to just do it for Irish TV. It's like, this needs real funding. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I really noticed when I started trying to pitch that in the States, you just have this sense of like, why are we going to pay some white dude to go and like learn, you know, there's just like a different perception. Now, obviously, when you watch the series, you go, it's not about whether I'm white or anything else. It's just like, here's somebody that's quite good at immersing himself in situations and connecting with people through language and humor, right? But on paper, it's like, you know, why are we going to get some white dude to go and learn Arabic? And like, what's he going to joke about? Like, on paper, it seems like dangerous.
Would you, what, like meaning like cringe or like,
no, like poor taste? Like, this is going to get us in trouble.
Okay. But like,
and that's,
but
why? That got increasingly more of an issue.
How are we getting you in trouble though? Like, something bad will happen to you, or like, it'll just be panned because they're like, this is out of touch. Like, what is dangerous? Yeah,
okay. So modern America, where people are very culturally sensitive, mm-hmm, right? You know, what gives you the right? So the conversation would be, and by the way, this is a hypothetical, right? Because I know what I would be doing in reality. But the hypothetical is, what gives you the right to, you know, like, speak about the Arabic experience. Why would we not send an Arab comedian, you know, to Egypt to do this? Like, who are you? Right. But obviously, you know, the, you have to have somebody that doesn't speak, because part of the journey is the language learning journey. Right. But it just doesn't translate great on paper. Now, don't forget, in Ireland, I'm pretty well known. So it's Des Bishop Goes to China.
Right.
Whereas in the United States, it's Irish American comedian that we've never heard of goes to the Arab world to learn Arabic and do stand up in Arabic about all these fucking touchy subjects.
Yeah,
I,
yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, no, totally. It's, it feels like dangerous.
Yeah, not to sound like stupid as I say this, but like in the traditional media space, heavy quotes, that is one of the big obstacles that I've always faced when it comes to like unscripted stuff, is that they're like, listen, we would give you the show if you were famous.
Yes.
And I'm like, okay, so makes sense. But also from a content perspective and bringing it back to what we were talking about earlier, something about being sort of more thrown in with different cultures when, and I know that we're a melting pot, like you said, but in Europe, you're like a 20-minute flight away from like very different people in every direction. And it makes you care more about what other people are doing. Yes. So like that show is also more interesting to me there than it is here.
Yeah,
and I experienced this too with the stuff that I'm interested in.
Yeah, but, and don't forget that the main Irish television station is the public broadcaster. So basically, like in America, PBS, let's go back 10 years, right? Because obviously the whole media landscape is changing. Let's ignore that, right? Let's pretend that the last 10 years hasn't happened, right? Right. But like PBS here is like fringe, like very sort of like, you know, what PBS is. Mm-hmm. But in Ireland, that's like the main station.
Right. Interesting.
And just as PBS feels like what it feels like here in Ireland, it's mainstream, but it's not that different. So you're taking like a PBS mentality, but you're actually putting, that's like mainstream entertainment. So Irish people are just more inclined, and European people in general are more inclined to think this kind of immersion experience is mass entertainment.
Right.
Whereas here, it feels like it's NPR, it's PBS.
Dude, when's the last time you were on the PBS app?
Well, I haven't.
But, okay, so the PBS app.
But I do
app,
listen to PBS NewsHour every night, but I use it to go to sleep.
The PBS app, there's so much original content on it, it's mind-blowing. They have scripted series on PBS.
Yeah.
Like, I'm like, what the fuck is this? Like, how? I don't know. Anyway, so that's a good comparison. It sort of, for me, it carries the weight.
Yeah, and I always felt that that was the issue when I would come, you know, I would come up against, not just with the China Project, but even post-work, you know, post-minimum wage thing. All the time, people would be like, oh, here's this charismatic guy that's doing well in Ireland. What could he do in the States? And I'd have meetings over here. But they would always shift it away from that public broadcasting kind of sensibility to like something more, and it would just immediately like not work.
Right.
You know,
right.
Or they would want it to be like something that you could continue to make season after season.
Yeah.
And it's just like, it just doesn't work because that's not the way the business worked over here. Like the fact that my first series was commissioned as a 4-episode series about minimum wage, or the China doc was commissioned as 6 episodes about China, and that's it. That just doesn't really happen here.
Totally.
Do you know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
So that's just like, that's just an industry difference.
Also, it must be interesting for you to be able to experience the ease of like making a show happen when you're a big deal versus a scenario where you're less of one, especially because for me, like I'm the amount of times I've been in these like really slow moving processes that now as I've been involved in projects from a higher level, I see how unlikely my scenario was in these past projects.
Yes.
But I thought, I'm like, oh, this is normal. This is going to change my life.
Yes.
Like, and it was nothing. And it crawled, nothing happened. And my original idea, by the time it was done, I'm looking at something that I didn't even recognize because I'm like, well, they know. These guys know. I don't know. You know what I mean? So I don't know.
Yes.
I've been through that so many times that it's hard to even want to try to do it that way. It feels like a bad way to do it.
Yeah. And the thing is that nowadays you could do whatever you wanted, right? Because you can just film it and make it. The problem is that to dedicate like a year of your life, like I did, you need to know that the content's going to hit. And then if you even said, well, I'm going to fund this thing by making content the whole time I'm there, it's like, fine, but that's not the same type of project that you're talking about.
Right. And do you feel, do you feel to some degree like you came back from doing that? It came out. Obviously, while you're shooting it, you know, there are these incredible moments. Some of them translate, some of them don't. You know what I mean? You're like, people are going to absolutely love this, whatever. Whatever ended up happening. Once the dust had settled, that show had released, what? How did you feel about the fact that you had done it?
And I mean, I felt great. I was pretty happy. The only, not regret, but the only thing that was a little unfortunate was probably just like the way streaming has gone. Like, had it been maybe 3 or 4 years later, I feel like there would have been a place for me to go, yeah, hey, we're going to do an hour-long version, just a one-off version of this series. I feel like there would have been a place for that to
totally
go.
Totally. Or even just like a renaissance for the series itself. Like, it happens now. So like, your licensing deal's done, and then suddenly it's on another channel and it pops off.
Yeah.
That
yeah
does happen.
Yeah. So that just, hey, but honestly though, like, it just never had the way it was shot, like, just the budget, it just never had the quality to like hold its own on a streamer.
Is there a place we could watch it?
Yeah. It's on YouTube.
What's it called?
Breaking China.
Breaking China, guys. Check it out.
Oh, yeah. I thought you'd seen it before.
No.
You never watched it?
I've never seen it.
Oh, yeah. It's an easy watch. Anybody that watches it goes, this is great.
No.
Like, it is an easy watch. I mean that in a humble way of just like, it totally works. Not because I'm great, but actually because like the subject matter is very interesting. And I also have terrible dyed hair throughout the whole of Breaking China.
Nice, dude. Nice.
I apologize because my director said you have to keep it dyed now because we need it for continuity. And God knows we did, because there's a couple of cheats. You know, one of the things we learned is like a documentary making cheat. The better I got at Mandarin, the easier it got to actually like organize shit. Because, you know, in the early days, we were using these like Chinese handlers and, you know, they're just like, yeah, we're going to do a calligraphy class. And, you know, you just see all this stuff to like fill up camera time.
Right.
But like a lot of it was just boring.
Slow.
We didn't use it. But as I got better at Mandarin, like suddenly like I was able to like figure stuff out and organize stuff. So actually what ended up happening was there's a lot of stuff in episode one. I'm just going to blow up my spot. There's a lot of stuff in episode one that we filmed on like the last week.
Oh, wow.
Because we were just like, this is what we know is fucking cool.
Oh,
now.
Cool.
So there's like scenes where I'm pretending not to be able to speak Chinese and shit. Not a lot, but there's a little bit of that. Just to, like, it just needed it.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. It's like a fun, easy thing to do. How's your Chinese still?
It's not bad because, you know, it's pretty easy to practice Mandarin, but it hasn't progressed.
How is it easy to practice Mandarin?
Well, you just, as I always flushing? Say, people say to me, which is better, you're Chinese or you're Irish? And I say, well, actually, my Chinese, because, you know, it's pretty easy to take a guess on if somebody can speak Chinese or not. But it's very hard if you're in Ireland to go, which of these 5 million Irish people is actually fluent in Gaelic? Because there's not many.
Right.
So you have to take a lot of guesses. Whereas, like, you know, like, there's a pretty good chance you're going to know if somebody. So, you know, if I'm pretty confident that they're Chinese, particularly if they're Chinese as their first language, I'm going to start speaking Mandarin. So I get to practice my Mandarin quite a bit.
And do people get a kick out of it?
Yeah. Largely, especially over here, funnily enough, like over there, you know, there's plenty of Lao Wai. There's plenty of like non-Chinese people that speak Chinese, so they get kind of used to it. Like the days of like, oh my God, you can speak Chinese, is kind of like gone. They get used to it. But over here, actually, the immigrant Chinese, like all the Fujian people that live near my apartment in Lower East Side, they don't meet a lot of fucking white guys that can speak Chinese.
Yeah,
so actually, they do get a kick out of it. Sometimes I get this weird thing where like, we'll be three sentences in before they realize that I'm not speaking English. Because they'll respond in English. And then I'll say something back in Mandarin. They'll respond in English again. And then it'll be like the third thing. And then they'll be like, oh, your Chinese is very good. Because they're like literally not even paying attention to the fact that they understood.
Right.
But it was fucking Mandarin, not English.
Right.
So
that
can happen sometimes.
Crazy. Does Hannah appreciate this?
I mean, you know, she does. But like at the end of the day, like the novelty wears off.
Yeah, right.
You but like, I love it. If I get an Uber and I can see, you know, the, you know, it's like, you know, Xin Yun, I'm like, yes, man, it's like, I'm gonna get my Mandarin on.
Get
man.
My fix.
Plus, you know, because one of the great things that came out of, because, you know, I have not performed a lot in the States in my career until after the China project. So 2015, really 2016 was when I started like actually working over here a bit more. And so one of the great things was that a lot of my English material about my time in China really translated over here.
Oh yeah.
So that was a huge takeaway from the China project, because like I really didn't have a lot of material that would have worked over here at that time, you know.
So what was that decision like? Like, how did you end up here?
Well, I didn't actually make that decision per se, other than after, so I'm like living in China. So, you know, I loved living in China so much that I stayed another year.
Oh, wow.
The documentary was finished, but I was like, you know what? Fuck it. I just like, now I'm finally doing stand-up in Mandarin. I'm going to fucking leave.
So what were you doing? You're touring?
So I was just living. So what happened was my first year, I was living in China full-time, making documentary. My whole life was China. I only left once. You know, I wanted to give it everything. Second year, I became an international comedian that happened to be living in Beijing. Do you know what
right,
I mean?
Right.
So I left sometimes. I did festivals around the world, went back to Ireland. But
what do you mean? Why did you happen to become that? Because the shows were doing well? Or what led you to be able to execute that?
Well, because I already had a career.
Got it. So like you could have already done that previously if you wanted. And now that you were in the East already, you were just bopping around at these different spots.
Yeah, but I wanted Australia, to come back to China because I wanted to continue to progress with doing stand-up in Mandarin. Like right. I got very involved in this brand new scene. Totally. You know? And so I was just so into it, right? Halfway through my second year, I did end up going out with somebody with quite a serious relationship. But that wasn't actually why I stayed. That happened in my second year. But I just loved living in China. But I went and I did Melbourne. I did Edinburgh.
Mm-hmm.
I did some shows in Ireland, you know, to make money. But then I would come back to China and like, you know, kept doing my thing.
And were you making a lot of money touring?
Well, that was just back to doing my normal life.
Right. But that is like at any given time, like if you needed to make a bunch of money, you could do that.
Well, particularly in Ireland, I could do that. Yeah. But I also like had a decent, you know, like I had a decent, like for example, like I did a live show about my time in China called Made in China. And I did that at the Melbourne Festival in 2014. And it did really well. And it did really well in Edinburgh also in 2014. So like I was getting quite a lot out of my Chinese investment.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
Other than the show. So anyway, 2014, I'm living in China full time. Like I'm living in China as a comedian, not making a documentary. And I'm doing stand-up in Mandarin. I'm also doing English stand-up to expats. And like, just, you know, like I'm like murdering. And this is the first time in my life I've really based outside of Ireland. And I'm like, I gotta do more with my career than just Ireland. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that's when I started doing more stuff in the States. Coincidentally, my mother also began her very long illness journey, which also was like a pull factor back to the States. So I started just naturally spending more time here.
Mm-hmm.
And but still was living in Ireland, but spending a lot more time in the States. And that's when I started doing The Cellar. And, you know, then I just started becoming part of the New York comedy scene.
Got it.
But how I ended up back here full time is nothing to do with any of that. It's to do with the fact that I got out of Ireland during a pandemic because one of the things about our family was we had this small little beach bungalow out in West Hampton, which sounds a lot fancier than it is, but it was a big part of my childhood. So I liked spending my summers there. And so when the fucking pandemic hit, I was like, I thought I was going to get stuck in Ireland. I was not going to be able to be
right
at the beach. So I got out of there. But during that summer, the summer of the pandemic, I noticed that Hannah, my now wife, was nearby. I did not know her, but I was following her. And when I saw she was actually following me back, I literally slid into her DMs and I was like, do you want to meet for coffee? We're actually nearby. And we met for coffee and like now we're married.
It's crazy.
So I wouldn't, like, I hadn't intended to come back to New York full time at all. So it was the pandemic that actually caused me to live here full time.
Interesting. Guys, Des Bishop, thanks for coming and doing the show, dude. Where can we find you? What's coming up for you?
Well, at Des Bishop on Instagram, probably the best place these days.
Sweet.
Des Bishop 5 on TikTok. I was the fifth Des Bishop there. I was the first Des Bishop. If you're looking for the linebacker for the Green Bay Packers, he's Des Bishop 55 on Twitter. If you find me on Twitter, I have no access to my account, so there's no point in engaging with it, even though I have 230,000 followers there.
But they're
lost like a Bitcoin with no password.
There's no way to get it back?
I've tried, man. I've sent email. I can't get a human. It's, you know, unless, so, you know, like maybe I need to get on Rogan and like finally have Elon Musk hear about my dilemma. Yeah. Anyway. On all the my specials on YouTube, Des Bishop of all people is what it's called.
Check it out, guys. Thanks for coming and doing the show, dude. Speedy recovery with the ACL, even though you did it doing rich people shit.
Yeah, exactly. The 1%ers have to have a good time too.
Yeah. You know us at Oops Podcast, at Not Julio, and Not Julio G on Snapchat and TikTok, at Ryan Is Really Polite.
Send us emails, and we'll see you guys next time.
Thanks for pulling up, bro.